cause you can. And you don't stop because you can. And you don't stop when you can. And you don't stop.
Hello everyone, this is Sean Ennis with the MMA Torchcast Special Edition UFC 73 Roundtable Reaction. It took a couple of days to get this going, but here we are. We finally had it going. Joining me are Jerry Cataline and Mike Jarslick. Jerry, how's it going?
It's going great, man. How are you tonight? Jars, good to
hear. Doing good, man. Mike, how are you?
Oh, fine.
Good, good. Glad we could finally get everybody going here on the call. We had some technical difficulties over the weekend, so thanks everybody for bearing with us. We're going to jump right into the fights here, but first let me get you guys' overall reaction to the card. Mike, what was your overall take? Thumbs up, thumbs down in the middle? What you got?
I did it thumbs in the middle. It was a good card, but it really didn't go over the top like some of the previous UFC shows, specifically the May show with Jackson and Rampage.
Yep. Jerry?
I'm going to have to side with Jars here on this. Considering all the hype that was around this card, Dana White mugging for the camera, boasting about the two title fights, it was a good card. It was a good card, but the problem is I think when you hype something through the roof, and I think, speaking for myself, I've been looking forward to this card for about 1 or 2 months easy. It didn't really live up to expectations. Maybe we set the bar too high, but it was a good card. I don't want to downplay it too much. It was a good card. It was good, but not a monster.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you guys that the hype kind of worked against it, you know. The funny thing is, it wasn't real hard to predict that this is how it would kind of play out. You know, we talked about on the preview that a lot of these fights had a chance to go to decision, and when you get that, inherently, you know, you're not going to have, typically, you're not going to have 3 rounds of blistering excitement a la, you know, Clay Guida, Tyson Griffin for every decision. You know, so I think that's what kind of worked against this one is that you had a lot of even matchups, which is a good thing, but at the same time, you know, works against the hype machine.
That's true, Sean, but I think there were surprising lack of highlight moments on the show. There was good technical fighting, and there was good cage mastery, and, you know, I think, you know, we'll get to Sean Sherk's fight, which I thought was just a brilliant display of dominating your opponent in a very blue-collar way, but there were very few moments that were like, that you talked about the very next day.
Yep.
Yeah, what the card reminded me of was the Pride Total Elimination 2005, where they had the opening round of the middleweight tournament.
Absolutely, yes.
There were some great fights on that card, and I could hardly stay awake during it.
Yeah,
I agree with that. I'm not sure there's a fix for that. I think that's just the nature of the beast. I mean,
it is. That's the danger in hyping an MMA card.
Yeah, I think that is. I think unless you have a headlining card or headline fight like Jackson and Liddell a couple months ago, which there was a significance to the fight itself. I think you run the risk of having fights like this, which, I mean, here we are, it's Monday night, where we're recording this, it was 2 nights ago, and I'm trying to think of the highlight moments of the card for me, and I keep going back to Herring almost knocking out Nog, and then inexplicably letting him get up, and after that, you know, I'm going through the card, and I'm remembering Frank, you know, Franca's knee to Shirk a couple times, Tito grabbing the cage, and, you know, Silva and Marquardt getting stood up a little too quick for me. But those are the salient points for me. It's only 48 hours later.
Yeah.
After 3 hours.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because it makes me wish that we were able to get the roundtable online on Saturday because I've kind of cooled down, you know, after a couple of days. But you mentioned Nog and Herring. Let's go ahead and jump right into that one. Jerry, go ahead and give us your thoughts on that fight.
Big A-plus for Heath Herring. Actually, A-plus with a little star because – and star like an asterisk, like Maris' 61 home runs and that sort of thing. I thought Herring really put on a good show that will keep him in the UFC. And for the life of me, I cannot – I only have one explanation for why he didn't chase down Nog after practically knocking him out with that vicious kick. And the only thing I can think of is here's a guy that's lost to Nog twice, And really getting the tail end of things on the ground with him. And I'm wondering if he just didn't think he had hurt Nog as much as he did. And that's the only thing I can think for Herring to not jump all over him and finish him at that point, because the fight was clearly his. And I'm thinking, you know, when that kick connected and Nog went down, all I could think was, this is the year of the upset. How could we not pick this?
Yeah.
You know, the third time, the charm thing. I mean, you know, all, you know, because I don't know really anybody that was picking Herring to win per se, outside of in the betting contest where it's goofy money anyway, but I don't know anybody that would have put real money on Herring in the sense that they really thought he was going to win, and I thought he acquitted himself well. On the other side of the scale, I thought Nogueira showed a remarkable amount of heart coming back and still maintaining his composure and winning the last two rounds and clearly winning the fight.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there was much dispute about the decision per se. So props to him, but I think it was an inauspicious debut, to say the least.
Mike, what do you think?
I thought that was the best fight of the show. Herring did a good job against Nogueira. This is probably his best performance against him. The first one was a little bit better than the second one. The second one, he made a mistake early in the second round, got choked out with an anaconda choke. And this one, though, he did a good job. He didn't do great on his feet, but he stayed out of trouble and stayed away from going to the mat with no gear.
Yep.
That ended up being his downfall, though, because when he dropped him with the left roundhouse kick, he didn't follow it up at all. And
no.
Everyone I was watching it with was like, what's going on here? Why isn't he pounding this one out?
Yeah.
And it was pretty inexplicable. And the only thing I can think of is he may have caught Nogueira on the chin with his shin and didn't feel it too much and didn't think he hit him that hard.
Yeah, our house couldn't figure it out either. I mean, we were all staring at the TV in shock, A, that he had knocked Nogueira down, and B, he let him up. I mean, shock was the word, certainly.
Yeah, and even initially, he did follow him down and try for some ground and pound, you know, and I've got the fight on right here. I'm watching it, and you know, he's getting these hammer fists, and, you know, Nog is, he's throwing up his arms, you know, and grabbing a little bit, but he was never really in a position where you would think that Herring should be getting frustrated with the ground and pound.
No.
You know, Herring never tried to mount him, you know, never tried to do anything like that. He just kind of got over on the side and dropped some hammers. But yeah, I'm with you guys. I don't know why, even at the beginning of the second round, I don't understand. You know, Nogueira was still wobbly. I mean, he was still in queer streak for a little while.
I thought, honestly, I think if Herring was fighting any other guy, that fight would have stopped. Because he looked too hesitant. Hesitant, and I think that's past experience. I think that's really the only legitimate way to explain it. I mean, aside from what Jarre said, but I mean, everybody in the arena, you know, saw Nog hit the canvas, and I mean, I thought it was over. And then when he kind of threw some strikes, and Nogueira was flailing, and to me, that was very close to a stoppage.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
it
was a couple of clean shots from being an absolute stoppage, because it looked like a fight that was about to be stopped.
Yeah, it looked like he was defending the shots, but not really. But he kind of just happened to be defending them. You know,
desperate accidental defending.
Yeah, exactly. It's tough to say what exactly was going on there, but
he's got to be kicking himself. I would think that he's got to be kicking himself.
Oh yeah.
Especially if he has the benefit of replay.
Yeah, he certainly gave the fight away, which I'm sure he's kicking himself about. But I think Jerry, you got it right when you said that he earned himself a spot back in the UFC. You know, putting on a show like this against the guy that had beaten him twice, I think really speaks well for him,
right,
as far as his future in the UFC.
Yep. And if you recall Friday, I'm sorry, go ahead, Jarre.
Herring's a very good opponent to put out in there against Nog. He's just got this style where when he goes to the ground, he's willing to give up his back, and he can escape from that position. He does a very good job. And it's really fun to watch Nogueira try to submit him, because he's a tough guy to submit.
Yeah, he gave up his back a lot in this fight.
Yep.
A couple times around, it looked like, which was pretty. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, it was entertaining to see you know, seeing O'Gara try and take advantage of that position, and Herring always was able to slip away.
Right. It's funny, you know, going back to the previous point that, you know, on the preview, neither of us could really figure out how this fight came to be, or
yeah.
really what the upside in this fight was. And, surprise, you know, and again, shows you what we know. Here we are 2 days later talking about that. I agree with Jars. It probably was the best fight on the televised card.
Yeah.
And miraculously, Herring, to me, is back in the mix.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, it's tough to say what to do with him next, though. I would say, you know, they gave him Jake O'Brien and Brad Imes, which really, that's two up-and-coming guys. Imes not as much as O'Brien, but, you know, you almost want to say, okay, now it's time for him to just pretty much fight top-level guys, you know, aside from the occasional rest fight or what have you. So it'll be interesting to see who they match him up with next. You know, is it going to be a guy like Verdun, or is it going to be a guy like, you know, like a Czech Congo type or what have you? But I don't know. I don't know exactly where they go. Now, Nogueira, I don't know if you guys have heard, Dana White is saying Nogueira's next opponent is going to be Krokop if Krokop happens to get past Czech Congo.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I didn't read that.
But... conference after the show.
Yeah, yeah, those press conference. So they did fight once, but by the time they would fight again, it would be about 4 years since their last fight, and you know, that was actually, it was a pretty good fight, and Krokop got you know, got the better of the striking, you know, which is not surprising before he got caught in the submission. But that would be, I think that would be a pretty intriguing fight after 4 years of these two developing as fighters.
Assuming that's going to be your number one contenders match.
Oh, yeah.
Pending the result of Couture Gonzaga, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would think so, too. And you know what will be a compelling fight to me is Nogueira Gonzaga. I think that would be a heck of a fight.
Oh, I think so, too. I think definitely. I guess, you know, I hate to say it, you know, because I hate to bring his name up, but what do you do with Tim Sylvia? I mean, I understand who he's fighting next, but still, I mean, you know, this is a guy that was the heavyweight champion.
Yeah.
Lost once and, you know, to Couture, and it almost seems like we're never going to hear from him again.
Well, he has the disadvantage of, you know, he lost that fight, and in the meantime, all these big-name heavyweights are showing up in the UFC. I mean, if you remember, it was going to be Brandon Vera, Tim Sylvia, until Vera had the whole contract situation happen, and Couture pretty much just happened to come out of retirement to take this fight, or else it might have been even Gonzaga that took that title shot, but there was nobody else. I mean, in the meantime,
right.
you've got Nogueira, you've got Herring, you've got Krokop, you've got, you know, all sorts of guys that are coming out of the woodwork, you know, or coming over from Pride or what have you, that are all of a sudden viable title contenders. So Sylvia, I think it's a combination of bad luck and bad timing, but you know, I mean, he's pretty much back in the mix with everybody else right now. I think he's in order to get a rematch, he's going to have to win a couple of fights.
I think he's deep in the mix. I mean, you're looking at,
yeah.
I mean, if you go through the analogies here, we have, you know, you have Krokop Congo, which Krokop really should go over.
Yeah.
You know, if it's going to be Krokop Nog, and then the winner gets a title bout, you're looking at the soonest Sylvia's going to get a shot is a year.
Yeah.
Assuming he
yeah,
wins
I
out.
Say.
I mean, Jars?
I
yeah, it's he's kind of lost in the mix right now. But the last thing I heard was they were looking at a Sylvia-Frank Mir fight. I doubt that's
yeah.
going to happen because I heard the athletic commission don't like that idea.
No, I can't.
Yeah, that was the last I heard as well. I think he is still tentatively scheduled to fight at maybe UFC 76 in California, but I don't know for sure if that's going to happen or what. But you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see them throw him in there with Brandon Vera. I mean, Brandon Vera is he's talking about wanting to fight twice in the UFC before the year's out, and I think that's a fight. You know, Tim Sylvia right now is a hard guy to promote, I think, to a lot of fans. But if you get him in there with Brandon Vera, who's got a long layoff and who was on a roll before he had that happen, I think that's an intriguing fight.
Another good fight for Sylvia would probably be Fabricio Verdum.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think that would be very interesting.
Yeah, I agree.
Interesting fight, but is it good for Sylvia? I think, you know, if Sylvia is going to get himself back in the mix, he not only has to win, but he has to really impress. So I think he's going to have to get somebody that's going to want to stand with him and strike with him as opposed to counterpunch him to death and shoot.
Yeah.
if he's going to be, if he's going to, you know, because I think Tim understands that, you know, he's not, he, you know, I'm sure that Tim reads the clippings, you know, has an idea.
Yeah.
And if he hasn't, if he doesn't read the clippings, I'm sure somebody's read them to him to explain to him, look, this is the problem. This is why no one's on, you know, this is why you're still way back in the mix.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think he'll be back. It's just a matter of, you know, I should say contingent on winning a couple of fights. I don't think the UFC has anything against promoting him, but it would just be a matter of him gaining some steam, like you said, Jerry.
Yep.
Mike, any more parting shots on this fight?
I thought it was interesting that you brought up Gonzaga against Nogueira, and I don't know if I'd really like to see that. I don't think Gonzaga really has what it takes to hang with him. And
really?
Just going off of watching submission grappling and seeing Marcelo Garcia up against Gonzaga, and against a quicker fighter, Gonzaga has a lot of trouble.
Interesting.
Is Nog what you would consider a quicker fighter, though? I guess
yeah.
I didn't see that in this. I mean, I watched, you know, I watched him in Pride a few times, but he didn't strike me as quick. Isn't the word I would use, I guess. And I just looking at him, I mean, I'll admit some ignorance here, certainly. Is Gonzaga really that slow?
Gonzaga is a lot slower than a guy like Nogueira would be or Verdum would be once it gets to the ground. You could see, and maybe it was just because of the size difference, but against Garcia in submission grappling, it was just Garcia was running circles around him. He was actually jumping up to get the back mount.
Wow. Yeah, and Gonzaga is a big, big guy, a guy that you would not see cut down to light heavyweight. I don't think he could even think about doing that.
No.
Do you think that, I mean, Gonzaga has shown that he's got pretty good ground and pound. Do you think that would work into his favor, or would he pretty much still have some trouble with a guy like that?
He would still have some trouble with Nogueira, because if Nogueira keeps it on the feet, he's a much better striker than Gonzaga.
Yeah,
his boxing is just very crisp right now.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be interested to see. It's intriguing to me. Not having seen a lot of submission grappling myself, that's an interesting angle to have, though. They're an interesting way to look at it. Go ahead.
If it's for the belt, I mean, the way this would come about, I assume, is, you know, Gonzaga being the title holder. I think it would be a nifty fight. You know, I think when we look into some of the specialties of some of these fighters and look a little closer at what each one does well, I could see Gonzaga being jumped around by some guy that's either A, a little smaller, or B, a lot faster than him. But I don't think he can discount. I mean, I don't think he can really discount necessarily the mojo of having the belt. Number one, and number two, just the mixed aspect of it. I mean, you know, in terms of striking, I mean, Gabriel Gonzaga probably is not the world's best striker, but he knocked out, you know, Mirko Krokop, who is a feared striker, and ground and pound him to death. And, you know, it's granted that, you know, Krokop is not probably as decorated for his ground skills as he is his striking, obviously. But still, it's the mixed aspect of it that makes it – I think the mixed aspect of it is what makes it intriguing.
It's
an interesting fight to see. I just – don't see it being as competitive as most would think going in.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, I'd be interested in it. Okay, good. Well, let's look at our second fight. We had a lightweight title fight. Unless anyone had anything else to say about that one.
Now roll along, Shawnee.
Oh, now I'm done.
Good. let's go with the lightweight title fight. We had Emmys Franca and Sean Sherk. Mike, why don't you take the lead on this one?
Okay, it was pretty much a one-round fight, and that round consisted of Hermes Franca coming out and landing a knee, Sean Sherk taking him down off of that, and pretty much passing his guard at will, jumping around to all types of positions, and not much else happened. It was an exciting fight if you enjoy watching the positional transitions that Sherk had, which were absolutely great. But it was probably boring to most people. I enjoyed the fight. It was a very fast pace. It just not much happened in it.
Yeah. Jerry?
Yeah, I guess I'd have to agree with that. I mean, I'm clearly not as technically knowledgeable as Jars is, but there's not much else you can say really on this. I mean, I'm wondering when or if Shirk can really pick up enough ground and pound skills to take advantage of his excellent technical wrestling, because he certainly had the advantage positionally all night long. He certainly was willing enough to eat the shot to get inside. He's got a granite chin, because the knees he took in, I think that was the second, third round on his way in, were just brutal. But he's got a gas tank like no other. And I'm not sure if you can, you know, and Jarvis, you probably could answer this. I don't know, can you teach somebody that sort of thing? I mean, clearly he gets himself in great position, and I was surprised he couldn't land more dominating blows on Franca. Is that a credit to Franca, or is that a detriment to Shirk?
I saw it as being mostly a deficiency with Shirk, and the reason why is there were very few times that I saw Franca and Shirk pass Franca's guard, and I said to myself, you know what, he let him pass there. And the one time was when Shirk passed into Mount, and Franca hit the Upa in order to reverse him, and that was very a very nice setup to that move. And other than that, it looked like Franca was just dominated, and Shirk didn't take advantage of it at all.
Okay, so I guess part two of the question would be, can you teach ground and pound skills?
Yeah, you can definitely teach ground and pound.
Because I would think that Shirk could be the champion certainly for the foreseeable future based on his positional wrestling. But, I mean, I think at some point you gotta finish, you know, or develop finishing skills that you can take somebody out.
Yeah.
And I thought he had Franca in positional trouble all night long. And we were all, you know, gathered around the TV waiting for him to land a shot or two that would start the cascade that would lead to the stoppage that we kind of expected. And it just never happened. I don't want to say it was a boring fight per se, because it kept me on my edge of my seat waiting to see the finish. But near the end of the fifth round, I realized there would be no finish.
Yeah.
And it kind of lost its luster a little bit, because Jarvis hit it right on the head. It was a one-round fight that just repeated five times.
Yeah. Yeah, I was definitely with you guys on this fight. I did give it 3 stars minus because I thought, you know, I mean, the first couple of rounds were really entertaining, I thought. Especially, you know, as you said, seeing Shirk take those knees, and those were hellacious knees. I mean, he ducked into them, and they were, you know, big knees. And
they were fight-ending knees. I mean, they were fight-ending knees. I mean, replayed that, his face just looked like jello.
Yeah,
it was a hellacious shot.
Yeah, those are knees that send you to the ground, and then the guy jumps on you and finishes you. But he just took and kept going, and got caught in the guillotine a couple of times after that, and was able to just pull right out of it.
Yep.
I just thought that was just remarkable. And, you know, the way you said, you're exactly right. He dominated the position the entire fight. Franca just had nothing for him on the ground, and this is a guy who's got tremendous jiu-jitsu skills as far as mixed martial arts goes, and, you know, was just unable to do anything with him. I mean, Shirk was just all over him, passing his guard, passing in the mount, you know, side control, whatever he wanted, he basically did. And I thought it was just a great show to put on by Shirk. I think this really was his coming out party as a lightweight champion. You know, it's really, there's really not too much else to say about it. Like you said, it was pretty much a one-round fight. You know, you knew after the first round that if Franca couldn't get the stoppage, there was no way he was doing anything. He couldn't win the fight. I mean, it was apparent.
I guess the big question is, who's next?
Well, if word on the street is right, it could be BJ Penn.
Yeah, that was also announced at the press conference, that BJ Penn was going to be getting the next lightweight title shot in November.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
And I think now, for my money, that's a pretty intriguing fight, because BJ Penn, you know, granted, Jens Pulver, I don't think is a great big test for him at this point. When he's motivated and when he's in good shape. But he looked tremendous against Pulver.
Yeah, considering we both picked against him.
I know. But we picked against him with the caveat that we had to go by past performance. And when
BJ
Penn is not real motivated, he's not the most exciting guy. I mean, he's still a good fighter, but he's not a world beater like he is at 155, I think. You know, if he can get up for this fight, for Shirk, like he did against Jens Pulver, I'm very intrigued to see how he handles Sean Shirk, because BJ Penn is a very cerebral guy. So is Shirk. And Penn is the most flexible, you know, he's like a plastic man. You know, you can bend him into pretzels and it doesn't even faze him. So what do you think, Mike, what do you think about that kind of potential fight?
One of the things I never can do is bet against BJ Penn. The guy is way too talented. And I know he has motivational issues, but the way I look at it, he should beat every single person out there.
Yeah.
And I definitely think that he would give Sean Sherk a lot of trouble.
Oh, I'm sure. I think if he fights like he did, against Pulver, I think he would give Sherk a lot of trouble. I guess, and see, the problem with a fight like we just saw Sherk fight is it's hard to look at that fight and say to yourself, who is the guy that's going to step up and beat that? Do you know what I mean? In terms of what that guy's going to bring to the table. Because, I mean, Sherk just looks like a bulldozer.
Yeah.
And that he's just going to run you over. Now, he may not damage you to the point where you're done, but he's just going to run over you and run over you and run over you and run over you, and you know he's going to be in shape. And I guess if I look out there after BJ Penn, who else is there?
Yeah.
I guess that's probably the better question. I mean, after BJ Penn, who allegedly wants to go back to welterweight, I thought.
That was the original. I think that was the original thought, but I think he's leaning towards staying a lightweight, which I really hope he does that. I think that would be a tremendous thing if he were to stay a lightweight for the foreseeable future and see what he could do there. But you know, if you look at the guys that beat Sean Sherk, you know, Matt Hughes and George St. Pierre. Granted, these are guys that both own tremendous size advantage over Sherk, but they beat him by, you know, St. Pierre in particular, beat him by stuffing his takedowns and punishing him.
Yep.
And, you know, that's something that BJ Penn could do. I mean, BJ Penn hits hard and has got very, you know, obviously got world-class ground skills. So if he takes that formula and is able to stop Shirk's takedowns if he wants to even, you know, I mean, that's the whole thing. Would he even want to stop Shirk's takedowns? I don't know. I mean, I think probably because, you know, having Sherk on top of you is probably not the best position to be in, but BJ Penn, even from the bottom, is just tremendous. Mike, how do you think that fight would go if you had to speculate?
I think it would go, it's tough to say, okay? I've never seen BJ Penn submit anyone from bottom.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he ever has, and it's just something I can't recall right now. And I think that a fighter that Sean Sherk is going to have a lot of trouble against is a fighter like Shinya Aoki, who has real good submissions from the bottom.
Ding.
Yeah, yeah.
Ding. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The other guy I can think of that would probably be a worse opponent for Sherk would probably be Vitor Ribeiro.
Mm.
And those would probably be the two toughest guys.
I'd love to. Go ahead.
BJ is going to be able to keep the fight on his feet more than Hermes was able to do because he just got tremendous takedown defense. And if he can keep it up there for at least two rounds, and I believe he should be a better striker than Sherk.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the feet for sure.
Mm-hmm. And the reason why I think Sherk is susceptible to submissions by a guy from the bottom is because he's a very aggressive wrestler. And there's chances he can make a mistake. The more aggressive you are, the more likely it is you're going to make a mistake. It's not like a Matt Hughes-type power wrestler that's just going to hold you down. He's always moving when he's on top.
Yep. I think that plays into his strengths, though, in terms of pulling out these decisions. Because there's really, you know, it was funny because there was really no point in that fight that you were looking at the fight and thought to yourself, why isn't this getting stood up? Because he was so active, because he was always moving, changing position, transitioning, and it really never crossed your mind that they're going to stand it up at any particular point because there wasn't that lull in action that you get with some fighters.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Jarvis. I think Shinya Aoki would give him fits.
Yeah. And, you know, BJ may, too, if he starts working rubber guard against him.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, is if he got on the rubber guard.
I think it'd be a dandy fight. And actually, having BJ Penn in the mix, I think they can pump this fight a little better. I think Sherk is a lot better than a lot of people give him credit for.
Yeah.
And in terms of marketing the fight, you got to have somebody that is, you know, media friendly, that, you know, can talk a good game and have a worthy opponent. And not to say Hermes Franco wasn't, but BJ Penn, in terms of marketability, is, you know, leagues ahead of Franco.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, it's a classic battle of pure brute strength, dynamic wrestling versus technique.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, BJ Penn is a lot stronger than he gets credit for sometimes, but mainly, I mean, his flexibility and his technique are his two huge weapons against anybody. So I think that's definitely, I mean, it's just such an intriguing fight. I would love to see that fight.
Yeah,
I really
hope
it comes off.
4 months, my man, 4 months.
Yeah, I really hope it comes off, because, you know, if Penn stays a lightweight, that just makes the division that much more exciting.
I would think career-wise that would be the right move. I mean, why would you want to get into that logjam at the top of the welterweight division?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
yeah.
just I mean, it's just so crowded at the top of the lightweight the welterweight division.
Yeah.
If you're
well, especially
BJ Penn,
since he's already lost twice.
Well, you know, but I mean, everybody loses.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that everybody loses. I mean, but you know, you can go into the much more competitive, but much more top heavy, I guess, welterweight
yeah.
division, or you can stay in the lightweight division, you know, a division where you're clearly better suited at this point in your career and potentially A, win the title, and B, dominate.
Yeah. And I mean, the division is wide open at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I see lightweight is still being a pretty weak division, because you have a lot of guys that really aren't top fighters there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can just never picture being a champion. Guys
yeah.
like a Spencer Fisher or a Clay Guida. And,
yeah. It's,
they get signed Marcus Aurelia, too. So.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a bunch of guys that are, you know, just out of the top 10. It's really really hard to rank them.
It's the kind of place where it's a really exciting division. You know, when you get two mid-level fighters matched up against each other, like Spencer Fisher and Sam Stout, and I mean, that was a great fight. But put either of those guys in there with Sean Sherk, and they get killed.
I think they get eaten alive. I think, and that's the key point to remember. I mean, when you're looking at a fight card from top to bottom, you want to see good, strong, competitive fights that feature some sort of easy to follow action for those of us who are not technically skilled.
Yeah.
But when you're looking at your top fighters, you want them to be, you know, if they're going to be the very best in the world, then they should be the very best in the world. And
yeah.
I agree with Jars again that, you know, right now the lightweight division, you could make the case that most of those fighters have not been active in UFC yet.
Yeah, I think you mentioned two guys that I would love to see come over to the UFC is Aoki and Ribeiro. I mean, that would just be tremendous, I think, additions to the lightweight division. But, yeah, the lightweight division is kind of reminiscent of the heavyweight division a year ago, except that there's a lot more dynamic fighters at lightweight than there were at heavyweight at this point. But as far as world ranking, I think it's a decent comparison to look at how the heavyweight division used to be. And hopefully we'll be able to see these world-class guys come over and see how the UFC guys match up with them.
That'd be interesting.
Okay. Yeah, it would. So let's move on to the third fight we had, which was the big marquee fight of the night, Tito Ortiz and Rashad Evans. Jerry, what's your take on this one?
I enjoyed the pre-fight hype almost more than I enjoyed the fight itself. Ortiz surprised me at how much bigger he looked than Rashad.
Oh, he was huge.
That was a surprise to me. I didn't think that the size. I knew Tito was bigger, but I didn't expect him to look that much bigger. And I thought Ortiz looked ripped. I mean,
yeah.
I thought he looked exponentially better than he did in December against Liddell. Having said that, a draw is always disappointing.
Yeah.
truthfully, I thought Evans fought a little too hesitantly against Ortiz, and I think that cost him the fight. I thought that Evans should have pushed Ortiz. You know, it's a playground bully. You know, I mean, you got to push back, and I don't think Evans did that until probably the last half or two thirds of the third round, and I was a little disappointed in the way the fight went down. Just, you know, it's hard to explain and grasp, but it just didn't feel, once the bell sounded, that these guys really wanted to go at each other, and they both had something to prove per se. I thought Evans almost looked nervous to me, the way he fought against Ortiz in the beginning. And I'm not sure if that's the aura of Tito Ortiz or not, but I thought that Evans almost looked like he was fighting not to lose the first half of the fight, and I think that cost him. Tito's grabbing the fence. Well, you know, the analogy to me, you know, we're watching the fight with a bunch of hockey fans, and the analogy was, you know, the old-style Philadelphia Flyers who would take as many penalties, you know, a ton of penalties, but they'd get away with a lot more. And,
yep.
You know, it's not cheating until you get caught. And I love this quote after the fight, something to the effect of, if you're not cheating, you're not trying, or something like that. And that was the best line of the night at our house, hands down. We voted for that. Comedy gold rolling on the floor, no doubt.
Yeah.
But it was a tough fight because, you know, you wanted to see one of these guys take a step forward, and I'm not sure either one of them did.
Yep.
You know, quite honestly. Either you wanted to see Ortiz go over Evans and show that he is legitimately still a world title contender, or you wanted to see Evans go over Ortiz to prove that, you know, he is somebody to be reckoned with. And you really didn't see that at all. And I'm not sure it really made points for either guy, in my opinion.
Yeah. Mike, what was your take?
Overall, I thought it was a really boring fight. They both kind of neutralized each other. Evans is not as good as most people think. The fight against Sean Salmon back in January, if you guys remember, while it did have the tremendous knockout, it ended the fight. It was Sean Salmon's fight up until that point.
Yeah, yep. True.
Yep.
And you saw, Sean Salmon's a mid-level guy that even he doesn't feel he belongs in the UFC. So it's just one of those things that they gave this fight to Evans a little bit too early. I think he gained a lot of confidence in there, though, against Ortiz because he did go to a draw with him. And the only thing is, I don't think his stand-up is really up to par yet. And he really has to utilize his wrestling, which he didn't do. He did do a good job on the ground, getting back to his feet and pretty much neutralizing Ortiz's ground and pound.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think Ortiz attempted to throw elbows at him. He was just holding on, trying to keep him down.
Yeah, when he was able to, not have his back against the ground, I think that really worked to his advantage. And, you know, that was obviously a conscious thing for him, was to kind of sit up. Even as Tito was holding him down, he was sitting up with his back against the fence to kind of keep himself from getting elbowed, whereas he probably would have been elbowed, you know, a la Forrest Griffin if he was able to actually get him on his back. But I'm with you guys. You know, I think Evans is a guy with a ton of potential, but he just got shy in the spotlight. It seemed to me anyway that he didn't really come into his rhythm until that last round. And he really, at the very end of that fight when he got that takedown, that was a really impressive takedown.
Yeah.
On a guy that was a lot bigger than he was. And Rashad looked like he could almost fight at 185 if he wanted to in this fight, you know. I don't know. What do you think? Is Rashad big enough to stay at 205? I mean, he fought at heavyweight before, obviously. But, you know, he's in there with Ortiz, who didn't look huge against Chuck Liddell and, you know, looked like a monster against Evans. I mean, put him in there with a guy like, say, Lyoto Machida. Machida's a monster.
Yeah, I kind of thought that myself. I mean, like I said, the biggest thing I took away from this fight was how much bigger Ortiz was than Evans. I mean, I understand weight cutting, and I understand that, you know, the principles and what happens on fight night and whatnot. But physically, Ortiz looked a ton bigger than Evans. I mean, just a ton. I didn't realize, visually there would be that much of a size difference.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering. You know, I'm wondering if he would almost be a better guy to fight at 185 based on his, you know, wrestling skills, and if he improves his striking, it might be a better division for him. Because I'm visualizing him against, you know, right now the top fighters who, you know, you look at your Liddell and Rua and obviously, you know, Jackson's your champion. All these guys will dwarf Evans.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't see him. Based on what I saw two nights ago, I'm not sure I would consider Evans a legitimate light heavyweight contender, even if he improves his skills. I mean, physically, I'm not sure how he matches up against these guys that are just bigger than he is.
You also have to remember, too, when a wrestler isn't cutting weight, there's usually a pretty good reason for it. And it may be that he doesn't feel comfortable with that weight. He feels weak when he gets down there.
Could be. Now, would you consider Rashad a guy that's just kind of in the middle? I mean, clearly he's too small to be a heavyweight, but, I mean, like I said, I look at him, and stature-wise, he looks too small to be a contending. Like, I mean, Rashad Evans is clearly a guy that can fight at the mid-card and light heavyweight for as long as he wants to.
Yeah.
You know, but, I mean, in terms of being the champion one day or fighting for the title one day, I mean, physically, can you ever see him matching up with a guy? Like, let's take Quentin Jackson, who's a champion right now in the UFC. Can you see him matching up with Quentin Jackson?
I can see him matching up with Quentin because he's a better wrestler than Quentin.
No, but physically, though. I mean, if they went in the ring together, I mean, I would think Quentin would dwarf him.
Yeah, Quentin would dwarf him. Rashad is a smaller light heavyweight, but he has the advantage that he's a better wrestler than most of the guys that are out there.
And he is very powerful as well.
Yeah, he is.
Oh, no doubt.
And it's just a confidence thing with him. I mean, Rashad. He wasn't a great amateur wrestler in college. It was just one of those things that he ended up walking away from an NCAA tournament with a big win. Okay,
right.
He beat Greg Jones from West Virginia, who only lost 4 times in his college career, and you know, spoiled him winning 4 NCAA championships.
I guess
it's good to have Mike around for the encyclopedic knowledge of the.
That's good. But keep okay with that in mind, though. I mean, they were, you know, Tito started trying to pimp the rematch almost immediately. Do you want to see these guys fight again?
Well, it's already signed.
Yeah.
Who wants to? Who wants to see that though? I mean, do you want to see that?
I definitely
want
to see it.
Why?
I think Rashad needed these first 3 rounds to get into a rhythm. I think he needed these first 3 rounds to get used to the spotlight. I mean, you know, he had never done anything more than main event a free TV event. I mean, this was a huge, huge fight for him, fighting Tito Ortiz in California. But I think, you know, after these 3 rounds, especially with the way he got that big takedown at the end, this big, powerful takedown, you know, it's just one takedown, but I think it speaks volumes towards kind of his progression throughout the fight, kind of climaxing at that point. You know, quite honestly, he did get lucky to get a draw, but, you know, I think it was almost a warm-up for him.
I'd rather see him fight somebody else on the upper mid-card. I'd rather see him fight somebody else on the upper mid-card instead of Tito. I'd rather see him fight, I'm blanking, but, you know, I mean, I guess if you're going to display this as, you know, a coming of age of Rashad Evans in 15 minutes of UFC glory, which you can, I guess, because
yeah.
I thought, you know, I agree with you from the sense that he looked very hesitant at the beginning and very confident at the end, then that's great. But I don't think replaying it against Tito Ortiz is going to, even if he beats Tito, I don't think that does much for him in terms of, you know what I mean? I think that, you know, we saw this act, and I'd rather see him against somebody new that he's going to mature against better or more.
I don't know. What do you think, Mike?
Well, the one thing I got nervous about as soon as that fight got over, since I heard the loser was going to get Forrest Griffin, was Rashad and Forrest. I just think that that would be a horrible matchup to watch. Forrest being tentative recently and Rashad being tentative on his feet, I could just see both guys backing away from each other the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely true. What do you think about the rematch?
The rematch, I like that better than the other options that they have.
Yeah.
Okay. It wasn't a good fight. It wasn't a good fight this time, but I think it's going to open up the next time.
Let's say Bisping goes over Hamill in what, next month, 2 months. Why not Bisping Evans?
I don't think Bisping's ready for Evans.
No, he's definitely not.
I think Bisping is a guy who needs to keep getting fed kind of lower mid-level competition for a little bit, you know, let him cut his teeth, let him look dominant, and then maybe a year and a half, give him a middle-upper guy. But Bisping is still a really young fighter, and he's really, you know, not very polished. you know, very, very strong, very has a lot of potential, but isn't quite ready for Rashad Evans.
Let me put it to you in this sense. Then, where do you put Evans in terms of the light heavyweight pecking order in the UFC right now? Because I mean, that to me, I mean, I could see if the Evans Ortiz fight Saturday night was a barn burner, and you know. Like, you know, Mike, you called it boring. And it was,
yeah.
Kind of. You know, and, I mean, I could see if it was kind of more of an exciting back-and-forth fight with the progression that we saw. And then, yes, I'd be interested in seeing it again, kind of. I don't want to see three more rounds of that on another pay-per-view card.
I think that's why we need to see the next fight, is to see where Rashad stacks up, because we really didn't get that answer in this fight. For only a round and a half is when they really kind of, and even when they picked it up for a round and a half, it really wasn't still full steam. But Tito gassed at the end of that fight too, you know. But I think, you know, another three rounds will kind of give us a better idea of where Rashad is. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I definitely don't see Rashad being in the top five in the heavyweights in the UFC, especially
no.
with all the new guys they're bringing in.
Yeah,
Shogun, Dan Henderson.
Right.
He would have way too much trouble with them.
Right.
If you're not going with the Tito fight, a good next fight would be Matt Hamill. That would really give Rashad a chance to show off his wrestling.
But that's the guy Bisping's fighting, right?
Yeah.
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 So
Hamill
was
a more successful wrestler in college, but he was also a Division III wrestler. I believe he went to Rochester Institute of Technology, and Evans was a Division I at Michigan State. So the level of competition was a whole lot less for Hamill.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, good for Tito, I guess. He's getting another payday. No, I mean, seriously. I mean, he, you know, kind of started self-promoting the fight right after the fight. He's thinking, Tito is a businessman. He's thinking about his next payday. So, I mean.
Yeah, it's looking like UFC 77 is when that's going to happen.
You know, I just. We'll see. I threw my two cents in on this, I guess.
Yeah.
It's also better with Tito than going with a, say, Tito Shamrock 4.
Oh, Jesus, no. No, please, no.
They did release Ken Shamrock from his UFC contract.
Well, thank God.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah.
Surprising.
Which is probably, what's that?
It's surprising to me. He did a good job for them last year.
Yeah, he did.
He drew a very big pay-per-view fight, and he had a very high rating on the Fight Night show.
Yep.
It's kind of sad to see him go.
Yeah, it is. I would like to see Shamrock have more of a presence in the UFC as far as a, you know, if he were to corner more guys or something like that. Of course, he's got his IFL thing going on, but, you know how that goes. Any last words on this fight?
I got nothing. But it seems that it sparked a little controversy here. So, I mean, if anyone's listening and wants to post in the forum to give us your thoughts on it, I, for one, am not anxious to see it again, but I think I'm being outvoted 2-1 here online. And that's fine. So please post your opinions and let us know what you think.
Yeah.
What I think it might be good for is a Fight Night main event.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. I think that would be a really good Fight Night main event.
Okay, I'm done.
Okay, well, before we get to the main event, let's do the swing fight. Kenny Florian, Alvin Robinson. Mike, what's your take on this one?
Weird fight for me. You had two jiu-jitsu guys going out there and throwing in some judo.
Yeah, that was odd.
I enjoyed it, though. It was fast-paced. Alvin Robinson hit a very nice Ippon Sunagi. I really like that a lot. And it's something that you see sometimes in freestyle wrestling, but you hardly ever see it in mixed martial arts. But it's a real nice takedown, and it can be hit pretty easy because it's easy to set up.
Now, was this the
it was the
the throw with the arm?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was nice.
Yeah. Jerry, what's your take on this one?
It was nice to actually see, some brisk action. at that point. I thought it was odd the way it was set up, because I think that if memory's not failing me, I recall hearing the announcement on TV that the Florian fight was coming up.
Yeah, I want to get to that.
We're all kind of reviewing the Silva fight in our minds, which finally was like a definitive decision, fight stoppage that I think we'd all been kind of waiting for a while, and everybody's about to go back to the, post-show revelry, if you will, and, there's another fight, like that. So I thought the presentation was a little odd, so I'm not a big fan of the swing bout way of thinking. But, as to the fight itself, props to Robinson. I thought he looked pretty darn good. But I think that boosts Florian just a little bit more. And I think, Kenny is a guy that I still don't see how he's going to beat Sean Sherk.
No.
but he's an entertaining fighter, and he's a guy that, I enjoy watching fight. I'd like to see more of Robinson, certainly. I thought he acquitted himself very well. And in terms of just putting two more guys into the lightweight mix, or I should say one more guy into the lightweight mix, because Florian's already there, I thought it was a nice fight to cap the evening. I enjoyed this probably, second to the Herring-Nog fight, honestly.
Yep. Mike, what's your take on Florian?
One of the things I've always thought about swing bouts is it's very hard to get a read on how good guys are. And the reason for that is they don't know when they're going out there. So it's very hard to stay warm for that long.
Yeah.
And it seems like that they were rushed out there rather
quickly. Yeah, oh, absolutely. They didn't do the ring entrances. They didn't do the vignettes. They didn't do anything. They just put them out.
And Kenny Florian, though, he's got decent jiu-jitsu. He has really improved his Muay Thai quite a bit. I just don't ever see him as being a top contender for the lightweight championship.
Yeah, I think
Sharp on top, since that's a very bad matchup for him.
Yeah. I think Florian's a really good gatekeeper. He's a guy that you put someone up against him to see if they're ready to move to the next level. Maybe if you get another champ in there. And Florian keeps winning, maybe he gets another title shot, but I don't think you put him in there again against Sherk, because it's just a horrible matchup for Florian.
I agree.
But, yeah, to talk a little bit about the swing fight format, I don't understand it personally, because, when you've got a pay-per-view event, you're not really putting on the show for at least you're putting on the main card show for the crowd. But you're not, the preliminary fights, I don't see why they don't just market four fights. You market four fights, everything else happens beforehand. And if you have time between your third and fourth fight, between your third fight and the main event, then, take an intermission and throw on some preliminary fights for the pay-per-view crowd. I don't get the swing fight. I don't see the advantage to, as you said, Mike, having these guys wait. They don't know when they're going out there. And then all of a sudden here they are in the octagon and they're rushed out. They have no time to prepare. They get no time. They must have ran down to the ring. There was like no time between these two fights. Everybody was all of a sudden out of the octagon and these two are in. So, I don't like that format. And you got Bruce Buffer right after the fight saying, and wait, we've still got another fight coming. I don't like that at all. And it was bad here, but it was even worse on the Shamrock Baroni card, because Shamrock Baroni was such a highly anticipated fight.
Right.
And it was like, you've got Ludwig Daly coming out there, and it was almost a letdown. I mean, that was a pretty good fight. And it was kind of like nobody cared.
Yeah,
nobody cared because what they came to see was already over.
I agree with you completely. I think in terms of production and putting your card on, I think that they have some work to do yet. It wasn't so bad on this card because there was there wasn't really a marquee name for the casual fan per se.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. There wasn't a headline fight in bold underlined letters. So I think you can get away with it on this card that way. but it just doesn't feel right. It looks wrong. And I mean, to say nothing of what it does for the fighters.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's different when you're watching a card and it's a live card and, you know, they've marketed four or five of the fights and they all end in the first round and all of a sudden you've got this block of time left over for your pay-per-view crowd.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then that's different because then you can replay your fights. But I mean, you know, when you're holding two guys in the background for hours, I think it messes with your product too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I would imagine you could get stale real easily. I mean, you know, in terms of if anybody who's ever competed in any sort of sport, you know, you're jumped up to get out there on the field, on the baseball diamond, on the hockey rink, the boxing ring, the MMA cage, et cetera, and you want to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's very hard doing it after a title fight because you don't know if that's going to be going 25 minutes or not. So you don't know whether to start
right.
the warm-up or not.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we said, I mean, it's pretty much in a nutshell, that's how it is. I mean, I don't see any advantage to having a swing fight format. I really don't.
No.
You know, the live crowd isn't into it, and to their credit, they weren't leaving. I was expecting them to be walking out the doors. You know, I wasn't really enamored with the crowd for the night, but they did stay for this fight.
I was surprised the lightweight card was so low. The lightweight title fight was so low in the card. That kind of surprised me. Fight two was
yeah.
all of a sudden the title fight, and I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, I think that was mostly because of, you know, since they weren't sure when the swing fight was going to be. I mean, again, that throws off your rhythm. You know, you got your lightweight title fight because they wanted to have the Ortiz Evans in the middle of the two title fights.
Right.
But you've got the unknown of when Florian Robinson's going to happen. I mean, just have it happen before the main card fight, before the main card shows, and you can show it afterwards. I mean, I don't get what's so complicated about that. And, you know, what's troubling to me is that we're three guys sitting here, you know, that do this as a hobby with full-time jobs, and we can come up with this,
right.
you know.
Right. I mean,
you know,
it just, again, you know, if you know you can have nine fights on a particular card and there are three or four, or in this case, I guess you could say five, but three or four that your pay-per-view audience is laying out 40 clams to see, I would think that you, in the space of 3.5 hours, could make that work and not screw up your live audience.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't seem that complicated to me.
Yeah, yeah.
The only place I see it being a problem to do it that way would be Vegas, because if you're putting five fights on before the pay-per-view starts, you're not going to have anyone in the building for five of your fights.
Yeah, that's very true. And
yeah.
my
the casino.
Yeah, my
yeah.
stance on Vegas, I think I've made very clear, and I say screw Vegas, personally. Throughout my time at MMA Torch, if I've made one thing clear, it's that I don't like Vegas crowds.
But again, though, and that's a good point, Jars. But I am 2,800 miles from Vegas. When I lay out my 40 clams for the show, I don't care if the building is full, building is empty. I mean, I watch Bodog. You know,
yeah.
It doesn't matter. I want to see the fights. I'm paying for the fights. I don't care who's in the crowd. I don't care if Michael Duncan Clark is there. I don't care if Kirk Douglas is there. I don't care if some blonde with, you know, a big rack is picking Chuck Liddell because somebody whispered that in her ear. That does not matter to me. And I suspect for most people that buy it, you're looking for the fights. And if it's empty, it's empty. You know, because everybody's in the casino. I got to be honest with you. If I was live at the card in Vegas, I'd probably miss the first couple fights too. Right? I mean, that's just human nature. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you got to have this goofy swing bout format.
Yeah.
Necessarily. I think that this is your card. If you want to, I think the doors opened in Sacramento, I think at what, I think 4 o'clock. And the first fight was scheduled for 5:10 local time. So, I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's an early start anyway. If you want to show up at 4 p.m. to get in the door, to be in your seat for the first, you know, fight at 5:10, so be it. If you want to hang around at the local watering hole or whatever it is you do at these venues, that's up to you. You bought or had the ticket given to you. But, I mean, for me, who doesn't have that option, I want to see the fights in the order they're supposed to be presented, ending up with the title fight.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
because that's what I paid for.
I think the other reason is Dana doesn't not want this to look like a boxing pay-per-view where you don't have anyone showing up until the main event. He doesn't like, you know, showing fights on TV with an empty building.
Yeah. I think you hit a good point there, and that is why I cannot for the life of me understand why they don't go somewhere else other than a casino.
Right. Then,
for these televised cards. Casino
then
crowds are horrible.
Right.
Terrible. I don't care where you go. Even the Florida casinos, you know, the Hard Rock there. I mean, it was fine because there was at least people there, but the venue was so small. I mean, if you go somewhere where there's nothing going on, you're going to fill the place to the brim. You know, you get a televised card. Are you kidding me? You go to friggin' like Iowa. I don't care. You know, you're going to fill a 5,000, 10,000 seat venue.
Right.
But I don't understand and I think you're right. I don't think he wants it to look like an empty arena boxing card, and that's admirable. But if that's the case, then frickin' go somewhere where you're going to fill up the place. You know, get somewhere where you're going to get some passionate fans in there.
Fill it up from the get-go.
Exactly.
From the get-go. I mean,
and you know, they're going back to Ohio because of the Columbus crowd that filled up the arena before the first fight started.
Right.
If that's what they like, then go to the Midwest because that's where you're going to get it. You know, go to your but get out of your casinos because you're not going to get it in the casinos.
Right. You got to get out of places where there's no other distraction to keep people from the lower fights.
Yeah, exactly.
That's basically it. I mean, but otherwise, I think again, I mean, who are you catering to for real? All right. You had, I think the paid attendance in Arco Arena was somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000. Somewhere around 15,000. All right. Are you catering to those 15,000 or are you catering to the hundreds of thousands that bought your card?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the logic would dictate that you're going to the people that are buying your pay-per-view elsewhere in the country and world, as opposed to, and this is not to denigrate the live crowd, but the live crowd is going to do their own thing. I'm sure if me and you and Jars were in Vegas covering a card for the Torch, we'd probably be there from the opening bell.
Yeah.
Okay, because A, we're interested, B, we're there for the fights, and C, that's kind of the goofs we are.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Joe Schmo, who got the tickets, you know, either given to him or, you know, on the cheap, and you're in Vegas or Florida Casino or some, you know, that sort of venue, you're going to screw around until the fights you want to see come up.
Yep.
It's fashionable.
Yep. Well, yeah, I think we beat that one to death. Mike, you have anything else to say about that?
No, I don't.
Let me get my stick.
Yeah, now that we've beaten that topic into the ground, let's move on to our the main event where we had Anderson Silva taking on Nate Marquardt. I'm interested to hear what you guys think about this one. I know Wade thought that it was an early stand up for Silva and Marquardt. Jerry, what was your take on this one?
I agree with Wade. I'm not sure it would have changed the fight, but you never know. Silva showed me quite a bit. I really thought that, you know, obviously I picked Marquardt, so shame on me. you know, Silva showed me quite a bit, and I thought he fought a much better fight than his last appearance. His striking is just exceptional. I thought the stand-up by McCarthy was a little premature. I'm not sure that, you know, necessarily it was altogether inappropriate. I almost get the feeling that, you know, I almost get the feeling that there was a sense that he was not going to let it stagnate at all due to the multiple decisions he had had before, or there had been before. And maybe that's not true, but that's the feeling I got. And then once they got back up, I thought that, you know, it was clearly all Silva again. And, you know, I think that was a big win. Rich Franklin looked like a beaten man already.
he did.
And I mean, that display, I don't see how Rich Franklin beats Anderson Silva. I don't care if they fight in the backyard lot in Cincinnati of Rich's home, you know, former home. I don't think it matters. I don't see Rich Franklin beating Anderson Silva. Based on their previous performance and based on Silva's performance Saturday night, I thought he looked just outstanding.
Mike, what's your take on this one?
I think any stand-up is too fast. It's just something that annoys me so much. And being in a live show, it's even worse because you get the people that as soon as the fight goes to the ground in 2 seconds, they're yelling for the fighters to be stood up. And it's just something that annoys me because it doesn't give the guys on the, when they get someone to the ground, any chance to do anything. And I don't think Mark Hart got a fair chance.
Go ahead.
The guy's great on the ground, and he did not get the chance to show that. They put him back on their feet, and it's really giving the better striker an advantage. Grapplers don't have that advantage at all. There's never a situation where two guys are circling, and sort of like Ortiz and Evans, and the ref says, okay, we're going to put you on the ground, see if we can get it.
That'd be neat if they did.
Yeah. it's just one of those things that it's a rule that makes no sense because even restarting guys on the ground makes no sense because what are you going to do? Like, say, higher rank takes guard or something like that.
Yeah, I can see the point on both sides. I didn't really have a problem with the stand-up, if only because, you know, and I'm not sure whether the rule is you're supposed to improve position or that you're supposed to try to improve position. Because Mark Hart, you know, I mean, obviously he didn't have a ton of time to do what he was doing. It was just a couple of minutes. But he was trying to improve his position, and Silva was just neutralizing him. You know, he would try to pass from half guard into the end of the mount, and Silva just pulled him back into the full guard. He'd get back up and dive in for a punch, and Silva would just pull him in and get him into the full guard again. And it just seemed to me that Silva was neutralizing him, and rather than have that back and forth, you know, and it wasn't really, it didn't seem all that likely that Marquardt was going to be able to advance his position. So I was okay with the stand up, but I can definitely see why people have a problem with it. But I was tremendously impressed by Silva. You know, once Marquardt grabbed the single leg and he was able to just whip around and reverse that and get Marquardt onto the ground and pound him out, I just thought that was tremendous. But as far as the stand up goes, I don't know. I was okay with it.
Yeah.
The thing to me is there's no reason for a stand-up. I can never really understand, okay, what constitutes a stand-up code.
Yeah.
Every referee does it different, and every referee is inconsistent with it.
Yeah.
Not like something like a freestyle wrestling where you get so long on the mat and then they stand you up.
Right.
Yeah, and that's definitely a valid point because, I mean, and they do the same thing in the clinch, too. You know, if they're stalling in the clinch and they're just, you know, throwing knees for the sake of throwing knees and not really connecting with anything, then they'll separate them at that point as well. But I think you're right. I think they do need to come up with some kind of standard as for when they do what, pretty much. Mike, what's your impression of Silva?
Silva looked great.
Yeah.
His guard looked very good.
That's what I was struck by was his guard. But go ahead.
He did a very nice job. Whenever Mark Hart would come close to passing guard, he would just recover guard real quick. It was really, really fun to watch. That was also annoying to me because, I was enjoying watching his defense. It was fun stuff. I was trying to learn from it and it just took the air out of the fight whenever the stand-up occurred. And it gave Silva a very big advantage, and he capitalized on it, so you really can't fault him for that.
Oh, sure.
Oh, I don't think the fault is, you know, I'm certainly not faulting Silva for taking advantage of his decision. I completely, you know, what is given to you is given to you, and, you know, if you don't take advantage of it, then shame on you. I agree. And Mike, you brought up a real good point, and I'd never really thought about it before, but it's one of those things where you're watching a fight and you think they should be stood up. It's one of those nebulous things. It's like a charge in basketball. It's like NBA fouls. You know, I mean, you know, sometimes it's very nebulous, and I agree with you. I thought in this case, I thought it gave Silva a distinct advantage that really he didn't need because he was clearly on that, you know, Saturday night, the better fighter. But it was bizarre to watch. And you mentioned, you know, It was kind of annoying because, you know, you learned from it. It was also annoying if you had bet on him in the fantasy contest. It was quite annoying then. But it would be nice to see a standard of some sort or just some sort of uniform consensus on what it takes to reposition fighters.
I really don't think it comes down to having a stand-up. I think it comes down to a stalling penalty.
Yeah, do you go to the yellow card, or what do you do at that point? I think that's the question.
I would say one warning, then you lose points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's as fair a system as you could come up with.
Yeah. And, you know, to me, and this will be coming up when I do some more writing one of these days, the 10-point must system is just a horrible scoring system for mixed martial arts.
Yes, it is.
I mean, to me, I just think it's archaic. You know, it's fine for boxing, but it just doesn't apply well to mixed martial arts at all. You know, to me, there should be different categories where you get different amount of points. But to say one guy just flat out won a round in general is just silly. And I think that's something that you could do with a different scoring system. You work in kind of stalling penalties into a different kind of scoring system. And I don't know all the logistics. It'll be something that I think about more before I start writing my next part of the manifesto. But what do you guys think about that?
Go ahead, Mike.
I've always liked judging the fight better as a whole because you walk away from a fight thinking, okay, I know this guy won. And there have been some situations in the UFC where using the 10-point must system, you walk away from the fight saying, okay, if that fight occurred on the street, I would have said that guy won. But 10-point must system.
Right.
And it's just something that it's an old boxing remnant that I don't think needs to stick around.
Yeah.
No, I completely agree. I think it's too easy for a fighter to, especially if you're only fighting three rounds. I think it's a little different when you have multiple rounds. You're a 12-round fighter back in the day, 15-round fight, where, you know, I think you can justify the 10-point must system a little better because you can lose a couple rounds and realize, well, I can make up rounds. But I think when you look at MMA, especially, you know, in this particular instance, the UFC, that you only have three rounds. So, you know, you can lose two rounds subtly and be done. And all of a sudden, you got to stop a guy. And I think, I'm not sure if it's designed to increase the urgency or if it is just an outdated, archaic system. But I think it doesn't help the sport at all, especially if you're watching the fight at home thinking, you know, this guy's down two rounds and he's got 5 minutes to finish this fight and his opponent fights defensively and, you know, he wins a 29-28 decision. Well, you know, I agree. I think there should be a better way to do it. And if that's, you know, if that's a system where, for example, you know, you have three judges watching the fight and they're judging, so who says they have to score by rounds? I would think that each judge can, you know, not to put it too bluntly, but have an overall impression of who won the fight or who they choose to win the fight at the end of a card, regardless of rounds.
Yeah. I agree. Mike, to get the last word on this one, what do you give? What kind of chances do you give Rich Franklin in Cincinnati against Anderson Silva?
Oof. Not good. I just don't see Rich Franklin winning back the middleweight title in that fight. Anderson Silva is a much better striker, and he's a much better grappler, too.
Yep.
And Franklin didn't look very impressive against Akami, especially in the third round when the fight went to the ground. He just looked out of his element there.
Yeah. And to me, I think Silva would eat Okami for breakfast.
It's tough to find a guy right now to match up well with Silva. I don't know if he looked to, someone like Dan Henderson to come back down to middleweight and fight Silva. I'm not sure if that would be a better matchup. I can't see how Franklin. I mean, he's got a puncher's chance, of course, but I just think it's a lousy matchup for him. I don't think he is. I think he'll go longer than he did last time, but I'm not sure it'll go much longer, especially if he's going to engage and try to take the title back by force. Silva matches up better against Franklin than probably, you know, most guys in the top five or six in the UFC. I mean, Franklin is made for Silva. I mean, he's a guy that's going to be right there and is not going to really try to out-grapple you necessarily. And Silva, he may not tie clinch him to death, but, you know, he'll find a way.
Yeah, I think that's the problem is Franklin's strength lies in when he gets close in and can bully a guy around. But Silva just can come at you with those strikes from close in, and that neutralizes. You know, if you've got rubber arms, then you're not going to be throwing anybody around.
No.
So that's the problem with Rich is he's going to have to find a way around that. But, you know, it's like Mike said, where can he take the fight where he has the advantage?
Right.
And I don't know that there is anywhere that he has an advantage against Silva. I think we're all kind of in agreement right then about Franklin Silva. But it'll still draw. I mean, it's still Rich Franklin. The fight will still draw.
Oh, and in his hometown, I mean, it'll be a raucous, it'll be a raucous crowd. But they're going to have to find a couple intriguing fights to put around it because, you know, that card's not going to – that main event's not going to go too far, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and one thing that was encouraging for me, actually, was the response that Silva got from this crowd. I think he was pretty good, especially after he won the fight. You know, obviously they got a nice stoppage at the end of the card and all that, but the crowd really seemed to respond to Silva, which was nice after I was not very impressed with their reaction to most of the card after hearing them boo, you know, a minute into the Herring Nogueira fight. I thought was just ridiculous. And over again, they would do that. But, you know, it was nice to at least hear somebody get cheered.
Yeah.
Besides Tito Ortiz.
Yeah, they liked Tito.
Yeah, they did like Tito. They loved him or they hated him. That was the thing. But, and then, of course, we had... Well, sorry, did you guys have anything else to say about that one?
Well, I was going to say, at least Tito makes you cheer, though. I mean, that's the sport needs. The sport needs guys that are maybe not polarizing figures, but they need guys who have name appeal that will get people involved watching the sport and build the sport. So you need, whether you love them or hate them, you need more Tito Ortizes.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you need more Quentin Jacksons. You need more guys like that. You need more Randy Couture's. I mean, you know, I mean, Randy is an outstanding ambassador for the sport. You need more guys like that that'll promote the sport in that manner. That'll encourage a crowd reaction. I mean, talking about this card with most people I knew, you know, you're gonna come and see the fights. Oh, two title fights. Oh, I don't know this guy. I don't know that guy. I don't know this guy. But boy, you bring up Tito Ortiz's name, and oh yeah, I know Tito Ortiz. Sure, yeah, when's the fight? Blah blah blah.
Yep.
So you need more guys like that that have name presence.
One more thought on Anderson Silva. The one thing that we haven't seen Anderson Silva do yet is really go up against a great wrestler.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a Matt Lindland or a Dan Henderson, and I'm trying to think other wrestlers in the middleweight division, probably a Frank Trigg.
Yeah.
Are guys that he could have some trouble with. Because it's someone that can take him to the ground and control him down there and probably eke out his decision.
Yeah. And I should say, I mentioned I thought that Silva would beat Okami, that they actually did fight, where Silva knocked out Okami with an upkick, but it was an illegal upkick when Okami was on the ground. Okami's a guy, too, that could theoretically, he's a pretty good wrestler, you know, could take you down and hold you down. I don't know if he's in the same league as you mentioned, Henderson or Trigg or any of those guys, but... You know, he's certainly a powerful grappler in any case.
Yeah, my dream fight for Anderson Silva is one against Kung Lee. I think that would be a feature.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
you got to want to see how San Shao is going to hold up against the top-level guys, you know?
Well, Silva, he's been susceptible to the jumping scissor takedown before.
Very true. good. Okay, well, after the main event, we had the swing fight, which we talked about, and then we got an advertisement for a movie, which just annoyed the crap out of me.
and we saw a submission of the night from Chris Lytle, which was just looked spectacular. A triangle from the top with a combination armbar to boot. I thought that was amazing. Mike, what was your take on that one?
I like that a lot. It's one of those submissions that I don't think the triangle really had much to do with it.
Yeah.
Whenever you're in side control and you're going for a Kimura, okay, what some guys will do is they'll move to north-south and pretty much sit on their opponent's head, okay, to sort of isolate the arm and the shoulder and then pull the arm out and then jam it back. And I think he was going for more of something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it looked like it was the way he had that arm bar. It looked almost like it was leaning towards being a Kimura, but he just happened to be hyperextending the elbow. But, yeah, it was a very cool-looking submission. And he got – you know, what bothered me, though, about this is that fight was only 2 minutes and 15 seconds long. They can't show that whole fight.
You know? Right there. I was just going to say that, you know. Honestly, and that is my – you got the casino thing as your pet peeve. I got this as my pet peeve. We should have seen that fight.
Yeah.
Should have seen that fight. No reason not to show that fight instead of that stupid movie trailer.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, enough time to show a two-minute fight. Especially if you're going to, you know, make Kenny Florian and Alvin Robinson, you know, sprint out of the cage.
Yeah.
You could show that fight. Instead of their vignettes, instead of their intros, you could have plopped that fight in there, just it taking you 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, to do the quick intro. Quick intros, show that fight, and oh, and that was our submission of the night. Bang.
Yeah.
You know, that is my pet peeve. You know, there was no reason not to put that fight on at the very end. You know, no reason.
You know, you've also got, there were two other fights that ended in the first round. You know, you've got the Frankie Edgar fight that ended via ground and pound, I believe, or some, it was a knockout of some sort anyway, within 5 minutes. And you had Stephen Motter choking out Mike Nichols within, I think, under 3 minutes.
Right.
So, you know, I don't see any reason. They clocked in at about 2 minutes, 2 hours and 46 minutes. You know, you show all three of those fights. That's less than 15 minutes. You know, I just don't understand how that hurts you to show three extra fights at the end of a card that, quite frankly, dragged a lot of times. You know, I mean, as impressive as the fights were, you know, with Shirk dominating Hermes Franca the whole way, and with the drama that played out in the Ortiz-Evans fight, which ended up being a tremendous disappointment and being a draw, I don't see what your disadvantage is in showing three stoppage wins.
The casual fan watched that card and was bored.
Yeah.
Okay, the casual fan was bored by that card. Bored by that card. Casual fan. Yeah. Those with some knowledgeable, you know, who have been watching it to, who have more investment in it, get the nuances. But if you're just Joe fan that bought that card or went to watch that card at a friend's house, there wasn't anything there for you. There really wasn't. So why not bang, 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 finish your night with three big stoppage wins?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? To hook viewers.
Because
that's the last taste you get. The last taste I got is a recap submission and a movie trailer.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a customer, you're going to be a customer down the road. I would want to see Frankie Edgar's win. I would want to see Chris Lytle's win. I would want to see Stephen Bonner's win, who might be might trigger a memory somewhere from Tough Season 1 to hook you in for the next one in 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's the other problem I have is, you know, if you watch that Frankie Edgar Tyson Griffin fight, you want to see more Frankie Edgar.
Right.
And he was on the card and we didn't get to see him. And Stephen Bonner, you know, even if you don't know that Stephen Bonner got suspended for steroids, you know that you haven't seen him for a while.
Right.
And now all of a sudden here he is on the card and we don't even hear that he was there, let alone see.
Right.
You know, Chris Lytle had a great submission, but the last two times we saw Chris Lytle, he was in snooze fests. You know, with Matt Serra and Matt Hughes.
Right.
So I just don't, I don't get that philosophy. I don't understand it. Mike, what's your take on all this?
I just think they like to have more fights for people to pay for on the website.
Yeah. No, it's true. I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, it's, I think that's probably what the motivation is. But really, I think you could keep UFC On Demand and be fine with it. you know, and still sell your undercard fights for $2 a pop, and people would still buy them. You know, you've got, I don't know.
My problem is this. I bought the card, you know, and I understand it's going to may not be televised, but, you know, when they block out 3.5 hours, there should be 3.5 hours of programming.
Yeah.
Period. I mean, there should be 3.5 hours of programming. It started, and this is something that, you know, I stopped, you know, one reason I stopped watching wrestling pay-per-views is because, I mean, that's scripted.
Yeah.
I remember buying shows that went 2 hours and 40, you know, out of three, you know, they're supposed to be 3:15 or 3:30. But you don't want to blow off your people that are buying the pay-per-views, and you don't want to feel like they're getting gouged. I can understand, you know, UFC on demand for old fights, the undercards of the free shows, stuff like that, that's fine. But you know what? A pay-per-view card, the pay-per-view card should be seen. If you bought it, then you should be able to, if there's time permitting. Now, I understand if, you know, there was no way to fit everything in, and I understand, but there was no reason not to crank out at least one of those fights in the time remaining for your pay-per-view audience. And that's one of the reasons why I have not gone with the on-demand service yet, is because it's wrong. It's wrong in the sense that they don't maximize the pay-per-view timing now, and I buy the pay-per-views, you know.
Yeah.
And as a consumer, it's irritating.
Yeah, I agree. Even though I do have the on-demand service, it's only because of my obsessive compulsion to see all fights.
Well.
But yeah, I definitely, you know, if I could restrain myself and not buy it in protest, I would certainly do so.
It's not even so much not buying in protest. It's just, I don't want to, you know, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right. I mean, I'm like I say, for the undercards or the free shows, for, you know, undisclosed Ultimate Fighter stuff, for fights from old pay-per-views or that sort of thing, fine. But like, and like I say, right now, I'll be honest with you. Had they shown one or two more fights Saturday night, I'd probably sign up for On Demand tomorrow.
Yeah.
If they had maximized the
pay-per-view.
Good.
What else it could be used for is undercards of WEC shows.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. It just could be utilized in such a different way.
They have the rights to the Pride library now. You know, put some Pride fights on there.
We talked, you know, in the preview, we talked about the over-under on the fight, how many fights would be shown. And I was hoping around 6. And if you bet the under, you're a winner. you got 5 in a stoppage, you know, which is irritating. And, you know, you know, you called it. We kind of talked about it, that you could see the potential for this card going slow because of all the potential decisions. And it came to pass. But from a consumer's perspective, you could have done worse things than showing your consumers a good ground and pound stoppage or a good submission stoppage before they signed off for the night.
Yep.
Especially if you made them hang around for the Kenny Florian swing bout
after
the main event.
Yep.
Well, the good news is the swing bout took precedence over the movie trailer.
True.
Kudos. Thumbs up.
That is true. We'll take our perks where we can get them. All right. Well, let's wrap it up there. Mike, any parting shots on this?
One thing I noticed about the card is, at least with the people I had over my place, who are pretty hardcore MMA fans, they usually stop over for every pay-per-view. They seem kind of bored with it. There was a lot of discussion going on about the new Harry Potter book, and it had to be like the geekiest thing. And it just didn't seem like everyone was into it like they usually are, especially with the Strikeforce pay-per-view being a few weeks past. Everyone was really interested in that, especially the Barony Shamrock stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that really says a lot for star power, that even with the hardcore fans, that they want to see a fight built up, and they want to see two guys out there that they see as stars. And I don't think that Sean Sherk is at that point yet.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's the whole reason, or at least part of the reason, that he didn't actually headline the fight there the night. Shirk and Joe Rogan talked about it. Shirk is a guy who probably isn't going to get that fan following that maybe he deserves, you know, simply because of his style. He doesn't have that dynamic, really exciting style for a lot of people. I enjoy watching him. I know a lot of people enjoy watching him. But five rounds is a long time to watch a guy dominate position.
Yeah, I'd echo Mike's statement with a completely different group. We had a bunch of people over, and I am about as hardcore as it gets, which, you know, wouldn't go far in Jarre's house, I'll bet. So I had the other end of the spectrum, and, you know, we were playing some cards before the card started, and, you know, we kind of went back to cards during the fights just because you could kind of watch them over your shoulder and not miss anything. And that's just a vast shift from a couple of the previous pay-per-views where there was a little more action. And it does speak to star power. It's not so much even star power. You're going to sit down and watch the stars, but not everybody can be a star, and not everybody's going to be a headliner. And the card itself had some star power on it, obviously, but really just didn't deliver what you would expect. I mean, not every fight's going to be a barn burner, but, you know, there just wasn't a whole lot for you on this card in terms of back-and-forth action. I agree with Rogan and, you know, pretty much everybody here that, you know, Shirk's style is not going to lend him, you know, viewability credence. I enjoyed watching him win, but I can't say the same thing for the guys that were in my house, truthfully, who just weren't into it. And, you know, they're casual fans. I mean, they're the group that's going to push, you know, MMA to the next level. You know, are people that get acclimated with the sport with somebody that does follow it, and they, you know, some people pick it up and become followers themselves, and then they come to our site, and, you know, it pyramids up. It was good Silva got, you know, some sort of muted advantage from McCarthy in the stand-up to, you know, finish out a dominating win because it perked the room up quite a bit. I am hopeful we get back to a few more bang-bang cards, you know, in the rest of the summer. And I can't tell you, again, to me, the event left me a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth just because it was only five fights and there was time to pop in another one and I had to watch a movie trailer.
Yeah.
And like I said, I'll be honest with you, by the time that movie trailer started, you know, we were back, you know, full-blown Texas Hold'em again. And there could have been almost anything on the TV and we would have never known.
Well, the movie trailer was for the wrong crowd. It insinuated the wrestlers were gay. I mean, there's nothing passionate about that.
I had forgotten about that, but yeah, you're right. The line where he says, I wrestled in high school and I liked it.
Yeah,
like, why would you throw that line in there for a crowd that just watched a hybrid wrestling show?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
my last take was, you know, the thing that I went away thinking was the UFC really needs to treat its pay-per-view customers better. They really, really do in terms of showing. And I keep going back to, you know, watching Pride shows where it was just fights. Fights and, you know, a little tease here and a little tease there, but fight, eight fights.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to we're going to limp through five fights in not quite 3 hours. It's like, and that was when the Silva fight ended early.
Pride American shows were a whole lot better than the Japanese feeds.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Feeds, there was a ton of downtime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I learned that the hard way, but still. You know, it left an indelible impression. You know, I think they have to treat their pay-per-view crowd better. Because I'll be honest with you, you know, next time, you know, if it's gonna be a five-fight card with all this downtime, instead of laying out $40 at my house, I'll go to my buddy's bar, and pay an $8 cover, you know, and go drink $32. You know, I mean, that's the market they're going to lose. They're going to lose the home buyers if you don't put on a better card. Not in terms of fighting, but just in terms of promoting and producing the event. Instead of, like, Jarvis, I think you said it was like 14 minutes between fights or something.
Yeah.
All right, well, it seemed, and I said it seemed longer than that. It seemed like it was days.
Yeah.
You know, and it always seems like it's days. I mean, I just, they're, you know, like I say, the next one's coming up August 25th.
Yep.
You know, I'll go down the street to the bar and watch it there and not spend 40 bucks to UFC. You know, or $40 to Zuffa.
The big problem with the downtime between fights is the production values and the videos are very repetitive.
Yeah.
And, you know, two guys shadow boxing in the rain.
Yeah.
And followed by highlights from their previous fights. It's, you know, they don't think outside the box when they go with that stuff.
No, they don't. It needs to improve. I mean, they've done enough of these in the mainstream right now that the fight product is there. I mean, they have enough guys in the cage that have the potential to put on entertaining fights, and their divisions are deep, and they have picked up their biggest rival in terms of a promotion to take all of their talent, or most of it anyway, and now they need to get the actual production aspect going at the same level they have their fighters.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. I'll cut it off there. We're running a little bit long. But just as a couple in-house notes, I know some of the readers do look forward to the lay of the land feature. I didn't get that up today. And I don't talk about my job too much, but my boss is in town, which is, only happens about every 3 or 4 months. So I'm pretty much at work all day. So I will have the lay of the land out this week, but probably not until later in the week. So keep an eye out for that. It'll probably be the lightweight one to start out with and then the middleweight. So that's it for in-house news. Mike and Jerry, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, man.
Hey, I'll see ya.
All right, and for Mike Starsnick and Jerry Catalan, this is Sean Edison. Thank you for listening.
Throwing in the rock and the shoe shine.